people's economic human rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the 27th Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival, July 3rd through 6th at Waterfront Park, which benefits Oregon Food Bank and features Greg Ullman, Boz Skaggs, Los Lobos, Maceo Parker, Bambino, Charlie Musselwhite, Ivan Neville's Dumpsta Funk, and many more. Information, complete schedule, and pass information at waterfrontbluesfestival.com.
This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arms. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. By the baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The time is just after 9 o'clock. I'm your host and engineer, Joe Clement. Every week, our moles examine and promote thinking about society, history, culture, the natural world, economics, and politics from a radically democratic yet socialist point of view. We burrow beneath the reasons and reasoning of the so-called way of the world that dominates public discourse, bursting through the spectacle with a 21st century version of what Thomas Paine immortalized as revolutionary common sense. We agitate, educate, and inoculate you and all you share us with. On today's show, we start with Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis talking about U.S. foreign policy and the demands to intervene in places like Syria and Ukraine and China even. After that, Ivan Hale draws on her experience as a social worker to offer commentary about community mental health and the challenges of helping highly volatile people. Later in the show, I'll be joined by Hart Noecker and Nick Caleb to talk about gentrification, the right to the city, and a Pedalpalooza ride that Hart is leading next Monday that tours sites of gentrification around Portland. And finally, Laurie Mercier talks with Eric Duplass about the environmental impact of building oil depots along the Columbia River. Now we're going to turn right to Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis talking about U.S. foreign policy.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome to KBOO.
Great to be with you.
Phyllis Bennis directs the Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written 9 books, including the book Challenging Empire, also written hundreds of articles, op-eds, speaks around the world. She's hugely critical of, highly critical of U.S. foreign military policy. She also discusses alternatives. Phyllis Bennis, last week the president outlined his foreign and military policy ideas. He was responding to his establishment critics, not to left critics. For one set of establishment critics, the Republicans, the right-wingers, they want more military muscle flexing, intervention in Syria, the Ukraine, the China theater, as they call it. He also responded to liberals seeking more humanitarian intervention, including military in Syria, parts of Africa. His talk was pretty good. In fact, it sounded like he read your articles, at least parts of them. Tell us about his speech and what was wrong with it.
It's interesting, though. The speech was pretty great. There wasn't, frankly, a whole lot wrong with the speech. What's wrong is with the policy. The policy doesn't match the speech.
I mean, what his actions don't match his words.
Exactly. He's very good at talking the talk. He's got great speech writers, and he's a very good speaker. He's very compelling, very charismatic, very clear in some of this stuff. The problem is when he comes to walk the walk, it's not so clear. So it was very good that he answered these critics of what he called the critics of left and right who want to use more military force. Now, they're not really left, but they're these, as you said, these liberal pro-intervention types who use the frame of humanitarian intervention to call for military responses to pretty much any human rights violation anywhere in the world. And that was good. But in doing so, of course, he did set up a straw person. He only talked about sending troops. How could they want to send troops? Well, the problem is what he's doing is these days not so much sending troops, but sending arms, sending trainers, sending special forces, and especially sending drones. So the question of equating military intervention solely with sending troops is a bit of a canard. So that was problematic in his speeches. And further, he didn't acknowledge anywhere the results of these failed international military interventions. So he spoke at one point, for example, about how the so-called terrorists in Syria have gained so much strength and experience fighting. And he didn't go on to say that was the same experience they began to get fighting against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq. A bunch of these forces, particularly some of the foreign forces that are not Syrian at all, that are various international so-called jihadi forces that have ended up in Syria now, got their training, got their experience fighting against the U.S. in Iraq. So the question of what happens as a result of these interventions was just not on President Obama's agenda for this speech. That was quite problematic.
Is the Obama administration, it seems to me, is that they're very clever, actually, starting at the top, but they've in fact expanded the CIA, as in surveillance, for example, where the expansion has been just so immense. They've expanded the CIA special forces, I understand from reading you, and they're expanding this sort of clandestine, what they call unconventional warfare.
Yeah, what the U.S. has done has been to give up, essentially, on what they used to call counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency warfare includes not just killing the people you think are trying to kill you, but supposedly, what they used to call in Vietnam, winning hearts and minds. It means providing some kind of protection for the local population to win their support for the side you are supporting. In this case, say, the government in Afghanistan. If you want people to support the government in Afghanistan, you're going to go in there and build roads and build clinics and save children and do all that great stuff. And over on the side, you're going to kill a few people. The other version of that is what's known as counterterrorism warfare. And increasingly, this is what the U.S. is all about. So you don't have to send a lot of ground troops. You don't worry about building roads. You don't worry about saving children. You're there to kill bad guys. And it means you can do it with very few people because you're not trying to protect anybody. You're not trying to build a government. You're not trying to bring democracy or stability or anything else. You're trying to kill bad guys. And as President Obama said when he was announcing that U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan fighting for another 2.5 years, that the role of those troops has nothing to do with protecting Afghans. It has everything to do with protecting U.S. interests. So the only concern of those special forces, and increasingly, as you say, they come from the CIA as well as things like the Green Berets and the Delta Force and the Navy SEALs and the official special operations units of each of the services to kill bad guys.
Are there also contractors? In that 10,000, it could be another 20,000 contracted.
We don't know yet what the role of contractors is going to be, and this is going to be an important one. If you remember, when the U.S. was trying so desperately to get approval from the Iraqi government and the Iraqi parliament to leave troops in Iraq, you know, it's interesting to hear President Obama sort of brag about ending the war and bringing all the troops home. He brought all the troops home because he had no choice. He couldn't get the Iraqi government, particularly the parliament, to agree to the kind of immunity against being held accountable for any war crimes they might commit for U.S. troops. And the result of that is that you have a scenario where we may face the same thing in Afghanistan. It may be that the Afghan government, even though both presidential contenders who are leading in the elections, we'll know after the runoff in a couple of weeks, both of them have said they would sign the bilateral security agreement with the U.S. to allow troops to remain. We don't know whether that would include the exact language around immunity that the U.S. requires. We don't know whether it would include contractors. They aced it in the Iraq agreement, where the Iraq agreement said Pentagon-paid contractors had to leave. And they did. Tens of thousands of them left. But it didn't say anything about, wait for it, State Department paid contractors. So somewhere between 12 and 15,000 contractors doing the same thing they had always done were sent right back to Iraq, but their contracts were now written and their checks were cut by the State Department instead of the Pentagon.
Oh, how clever.
So,
yes.
He was very clever. Very smart guy.
Very clever. Yes.
Now, we don't know if that's going to happen again.
It sounds like shyster lawyers here.
Indeed.
This is KBOO Radio, the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Phyllis Bennis. She's a prodigiously informed, thoughtful critic of U.S. foreign policy. We've been discussing Obama's recent speech. He was outlining his principles, of which are fine, and he's quite eloquent in speaking them, and they're very appealing, actually, his principles. The problem is that his actual policies, that is what he's doing, seems to me much more, well, in fact, now it's a less sophisticated militarism, but pouring more money into various kinds of clandestine and special forces warfare. Phyllis Bennis, let's talk about what he's doing, both with regard to Syria and drone warfare and many other violations of any kind of international rule of law. First, talk about Syria as an example of what they're up to, and then we'll get into drone warfare.
Well, what they're doing in Syria, again, in President Obama's speech, he said very explicitly again, there is no military solution in Syria. I absolutely agree with that. The problem is, all he's doing is trying to bolster the military capacity of one side in this terrible civil war. And in doing so, he's not talking about sending troops. And in fact, nobody's calling for troops. That was one of the accusations from the Republicans. Oh, it's a straw man. Nobody is saying send troops. And it's true. Nobody's actually calling for sending ground troops to Syria. What they are calling for is sending things like these shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. Remember those, Bill, from the first U.S. war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, the anti-Soviet war, and the what they were called stingers then. These, you know, one person can fire these missiles to bring down airliners. And, of course, the problem is they can bring down any old airliner, civilian, military, any. It puts the whole world at risk.
Also, they're extremely valuable to sell to the other side, right?
The notion of sides gets very complicated.
Right, there's no sides, right.
The U.S. says we're being very careful to only provide arms to the so-called moderates. The problem is the moderates have very little military power relative to the acknowledged extremists. And the notion that they will somehow, because they've signed a form saying, you know, promising the U.S. that they won't sell them,
yeah,
doesn't mean that they won't be captured, because they're fighting on the same side. So it gets very, very complicated.
The arms get distributed everywhere once you start sending them.
And what the U.S. is doing, the U.S. has CIA trainers training Syrian rebel fighters in Jordan. The U.S. has given approval to its allies in the neighborhood, particularly Qatar, which they've just rebonded with over the organizing of this prisoner release, a prisoner exchange, we should say, where the only U.S. soldier that was being held captive by the Taliban was released in return for the release of five Taliban commanders who were being held in Guantanamo, indicating that, what a surprise, it is apparently possible to release prisoners from Guantanamo, something that the Obama administration keeps saying it wants to do, but that it can't, but apparently it can. So this could be and should be seen as a real precedent. But what the U.S. is doing is flying in the face of its own official position that there is no military solution, and the U.S. is not doing what it needs to do to have a non-military solution.
Yeah, why don't you go into that?
The first thing the U.S. should do is what we call do no harm. They should stop sending military force, stop escalating the fighting that's going on. Number two, because we know that stopping the fighting isn't enough by itself, that we need an entirely new policy. The U.S. should be calling for and should actually support an immediate ceasefire by all sides, a comprehensive international arms embargo on all sides, and simultaneously it should reengage with Russia. And now that it's having some motion forward in the talks with Iran, it should absolutely engage with Iran on talks to restart the negotiations on Syria that collapsed about a month ago. Despite the resignation of the UN Special Envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, there should be that kind of re-engagement, especially with Russia. Then the U.S. should be putting much more money than it already is into the refugee crisis, which is spreading across the whole region. This is a disaster that is having enormous impact on every country in the region and is, you know, making things very, very dangerous everywhere, particularly for the Syrians themselves. We now have somewhere close to 50%, it's somewhere between 45%, almost half the entire population of Syria has been forced to leave their homes. Almost 3 million are refugees outside the country. 6 million are refugees, or what they call internally displaced people inside Syria, not able to live in their homes. A whole generation of Syrian kids is growing up without education. It's a disaster. And while the U.S. is paying more money than any other country towards refugee assistance, it needs to do much more. And then finally, putting this in a broader context, it's fine that the U.S. is supporting the work of the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons that's overseeing the transfer of Syrian chemical weapons to international control. That's all good. But it needs to go much further and stop its opposition and really start supporting the efforts to create a weapons of mass destruction free zone throughout the entire Middle East. This has been on the agenda for 25, 30 years now. And it's been the U.S. and Israel that refused to allow it to go forward because Israel will not acknowledge its nuclear arsenal. The only way that such a zone, a nuclear and biological and chemical weapons-free zone throughout the Middle East is going to work is if it includes the Israeli nuclear weapons arsenal being not only officially acknowledged, but brought under international inspection and ultimately destroyed.
Phyllis Bennis, let's discuss the U.S. And international law and the use of drones and destabilizing other governments and so many violations.
Well, again, you know, we see in President Obama's speech and in other arenas, he talks a great deal about the rule of law. He is, after all, a constitutional law professor. He talked about wanting to close Guantanamo because, quote, U.S. values and legal traditions do not permit the indefinite detention of people beyond our borders. The problem is that for the whole world, that's precisely what defines the values and legal traditions now of the U.S. So it's terribly dangerous. We heard in some of the commentary about the speech this week that in describing his position, the president had used the sort of overview of, in terms of explaining why he would be against the war in Iraq, that the biggest problems the U.S. faces in foreign policy is overreach and too much militarism. Again, something I would agree with. It's just not practice. So his position was, don't do stupid stuff, except he didn't say stuff. He said, as the Times wrote rather primly, a saltier version of don't do stupid, which I can't say on the radio.
No, you can't.
The point is that he recognizes that a lot of what the U.S. does militarily is really, really stupid. So even if you don't care about the moral aspect, it's incredibly stupid to carry out drone wars without acknowledging them, killing so far way over 3,000 people, many of them civilians that happen to be in the neighborhood, in places like Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, other places where there's no acknowledged war at all. Drones dropped by the CIA or by U.S. military special forces. No accountability, no transparency, no acknowledgement. If that's not stupid, talk about breeding more terrorism when people appropriately get outraged at the drone strikes against a wedding party because somebody told someone in Afghanistan that they should tell the U.S. that those are bad guys. And somebody says, oh, okay, we'll just go drop a drone on them. And it turns out to be a wedding party and 12 people are killed from one family. You know, that's what antagonism is based on. That's what could write the book on what is stupid stuff when it comes to foreign policy. So whether it's the drone strikes, whether it's further militarization in Syria, all of these things are practically textbook examples of how to best get more people around the world to hate you. If that's what the U.S. foreign policy is all about, they're doing a great job.
Phyllis Bennis, thanks a lot for talking to us, and keep up your constant agitation work and education and struggle for a very different military and foreign policy. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Bill. If any of your listeners are interested, they can sign up to get my occasional newsletters. They can go to the IPS website, which is ips-dc.org.
Yes, it's very valuable. I look at it all the time. Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you.
When you're new in the world, you've a dream that is wild, and they tame you and mold you till one day, behold, your obedient soldiers, commuters, consumers. Reality rules and there's no room for dreamers. They teach you your place in the obstacle race, with the prize that you chase always just out of reach. And you're urged on by megaphone voices that offer you choices that are not your own. Only listen for the voice that lives.
lives inside you. Like a songbird in a cage, it waits inside us. Find the key to set it free and soaring skyward. Now the sky is filled with voices, hear them sing beside you.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Leon Rosselson's The Voice That Lives Inside You from his Look What They're Selling at the Happiness Counter album. I always like that song and think that it encapsulates something that we were trying to do on the Old Mole, which is remind you of the voice that lives inside you. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Phyllis Bennis about U.S. foreign policy and the blunders that have been made most recently. Up next, we're going to hear from Old Mole Ivan Hale, who has a commentary about community mental health and helping really volatile people.
Linda hid a sharpened pencil in her fist and waited. Just 17 and doing time in juvenile corrections for drug possession, Linda kept still until the guard drew close. Then she lashed out. On instinct, the guard raised his arm to block the blow. The pencil pierced his finger and also nicked his nose, drawing blood. She tried for my eyes, recalls the security officer at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility near Salem. The attack happened in 1995. Since then, Linda has assaulted a series of authority figures, conceived and delivered a baby while in state custody, and now lives at the State Psychiatric Hospital in Pendleton, where she awaits trial on a charge of using another weapon, a syringe. She has one more distinction. On her 30th birthday, which coincided with the start of Oregon's fiscal calendar, she became the most expensive mental patient in state history. What I just read is the rather melodramatic opening paragraph from an article the Oregonian ran in September of 2007. The woman in the article, Linda, whose name I've changed to protect her identity, walked into my office a few weeks ago. She, not knowing me, and me, her new counselor at the transitional housing unit I worked at, not knowing anything about her. She sat in my office, shaking and dripping wet from being in the rain. When I suggested we postpone move-in paperwork and get her some dry clothes and a shower, she laughed suddenly and nervously and stated loudly that she hadn't showered in 3 months, so a few more hours wouldn't matter. Her whole body was quivering, and I began to wonder with growing suspicion if it maybe had nothing to do with her being cold. A few hours later, Linda was in fresh clothes when she burst into my office, thrust a comb at me, and demanded I comb the mats out of her hair. I was surprised, as I was with another client, so I said, "No, Linda, I can't do that right now." That was when she threw the comb at me and screamed, "You people are here to help me! I need help! I need you to help me comb my hair!" And then she began to cry, and shake, and scream, and cry. That was just the first of what would be a week of random acts of screaming, crying, cutting, punching, threatening, triggering residents, several trips to the hospital, police involvement, and more screaming and screaming and screaming. While the average cost per psychiatric patient runs about $162,000 a year at Oregon's three main psychiatric hospitals, the article continues, Linda's two-year plan was tagged at $887,000 with the phrase, quote, "patient requires high staffing," end quote, as the explanatory justification. Linda's case rubs a bundle of raw political and societal nerves, says the Oregonian. The shortcomings of a criminal justice system poorly equipped to deal with the mentally ill, the delicate balance between protecting the public and honoring an individual's rights, the exorbitant costs that can crop up when traditional punishments and treatments fail. After a few days, my own nerves raw and frayed, I got curious. I Googled Linda's name and found the article of which I am quoting parts of today. By then, I had sat through several meetings about Linda with my boss and management, and though I insisted Linda needed much higher care than we could give, my concerns were essentially dismissed. When I found the article, I wasted no time emailing it to all my bosses and managers and supervisors, with only the suggestion that they, quote, take another look at Linda's case. I felt smug. I felt vindicated. I felt like maybe something would be done. After the 1995 attack on the guard, Linda was indicted on assault and harassment charges and moved to the Marion County Jail to await trial. There she filed a civil rights complaint against Hillcrest and its superintendent. Just 18 years old and lacking a lawyer, she wrote the legal documents herself. Plaintiff, Linda writes, referring to herself, attempted to get treatment for plaintiff's problems, but was met with a cold shoulder by agents of the defendant. Plaintiff was not accepted to participate in groups. Plaintiff attempted again and again to seek treatment, but nobody, none of the agents of the defendant, would actually sit down and help the plaintiff, end quote. She was sentenced to 6 years in prison. Not getting the help she wanted was the ongoing complaint Linda made while a client of mine. She screamed to get the help she needed, then later claimed it was not enough. At one point, she screamed that I was trying to get rid of her when on the first day I suggested she get out of her wet clothes and into something dry. After the article broke at my workplace, a meeting was called with management and county mental health authorities. It was determined that Linda needed to be in structured, secured housing and that we needed to discreetly move her there without her knowing she would be moved. Ironically, by that time, Linda had calmed down quite a bit. She had stopped screaming and was behaving like the average client at my workplace. The morning of her last day, we had an amazing hour-long conversation where she actually laughed and smiled. She had a really beautiful smile. At one point, she offered humorously, "Wow, I really screamed at you, didn't I?" "Yep, Linda, you sure did." After that morning, I felt so good and positive about her potential. I felt like a barrier had been breached. Later, I walked out of my office just in time to see Linda being escorted out by police. She had a large bloody towel wrapped around her arm. "What happened?" I exclaimed. "People were making fun of me," she said. "Because I'm a piece of crap, I cut myself with a razor." Minutes after she left for the hospital, I got a call from management directing me to not let her back in the building. The county was to take over now and move her to another facility and transition to more structured housing. "She's too dangerous," they said. Linda had only physically hurt herself while she was in my unit, and self-harm is practically a daily occurrence there. She was deemed too dangerous based solely on the 2007 article I had found and distributed. The Oregonian says that time and time again, she had to be taken out of her cell and restrained for breaking rules and physically and verbally attacking guards. At one point, guards wrestled Linda to the ground, put her in the shower to calm her down, then gave her a gown and put her in a segregation cell. 15 minutes later, guards found her with the gown tied tightly around her neck. By the time they removed it, her color had begun to change. Less than a year after her release, Linda attacked her parole officer, punching the officer twice in the face and pulling clumps of hair from her scalp. Instead of going back to prison for this attack, Linda was found guilty except for insanity and committed to the state hospital in Salem for 6 years. The violent outbursts continue at the state hospital, and after another assault charge, wielding a syringe, Linda was transferred to Blue Mountain Recovery in Pendleton. The Oregonian article ends with a spokesperson from Blue Mountain Recovery saying that despite enormous problems of funding, crowding, and difficult clientele, people with a wide range of illnesses do successfully move back into the community. The spokesperson said, quote, "I wouldn't say the system is broken. I would say it needs a lot of work. We do treat people. They get better. I see it all the time," end quote. Though the plan for Linda on the day she was locked out of my unit was supposedly set, neither Linda nor the transitional housing unit she was to be placed in knew this. Because of her history, the planned housing site denied her, and Linda back on the streets returned or tried to return to her former residence, i.e., my unit. She ended up sleeping on the sidewalk in the rain and greeting me each morning as I got to work by shouting obscenities and blaming me for getting her kicked out of the building. She got in at one point and poured hot coffee all over the floor and screamed and screamed. Eventually, she was trespassed by police and forced to leave. Last I heard, Linda was staying at a run-down, long-term motel paid for by Multnomah County funds. When I asked for more information on her, I was told, quote, "She's engaged in services," end quote. Sure she is. When I last saw her camped out in front of my building at work, she had surrounded herself with cigarettes, a wet blanket, a half-eaten sandwich, a spilled cup of coffee, and various offal people had been giving her as they walked by. Has Linda successfully transitioned back into the community, as was the plan upon her release? Well, she didn't stab anyone with a pencil, she didn't pull anyone's hair out, and she didn't get a new assault charge. But Linda is now the poster child of the failures of the mental health system. No agency wants her. She's now 36 years old, and she's got a lot more years ahead. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Ivan Hale.
It's the powers that be in their wisdom decree that you're no longer needed to feed the machine. The wheel turns, you're dismissed if you dare to resist. There are walls, there are doors to confuse you and bruise you. They'll label you scroungers and wasters and sponges. They'll call you subversives, wretched traitors and worse. If you don't fit the norm, if your ways don't conform to the rules, then you're out of the game. Only listen for the voice that lives inside you.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host and engineer, Joe Clement. We just heard Ivan Hale talking about her experiences helping highly volatile people. If you want to listen to any part of this show or the whole show, go to the KBOO website in a day or two at kboo.fm, and the Old Mole's page is an extra slash Old Mole Variety Hour. There you can find not only audio links, but links to other kinds of written material that pertain to our guests and topics. Hart Nowicker and Nick Caleb. Nick, as many of you know, was a recent candidate for the city council, and Hart is a bicycle activist and maintains a website called rebelmetropolis.org, where he writes about bicycling and urbanism and resisting capitalism. This morning, we're going to be talking about gentrification and the way that capitalism is shaping our cities, and a pedalpalooza ride that Hart is leading on Monday the 9th, that's a week from today, that will be touring sites of gentrification around Portland and helping to stimulate community conversations about what we might do about it. Welcome to the Old Mole.
Thank you.
Hi.
So I was talking with Nick the other night, and I put it to him, hey, you know what would be great for Pedalpalooza is a ride where we're going around different sites of gentrification and other sorts of development that we would talk about in terms of class war. And, well, he happened to be talking with Hart at that time, and they decided to come up with a ride. That'll be next Monday the 9th at 5:30, starting in Colonel Sumner's Park. But before we talk about that, I want to address the issue of gentrification and ask you guys about your experiences with it and why you're organizing around it. Why don't you start, Hart?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a thing that we've kind of watched happen. I moved here about 10 years ago, as did a lot of people. And since then, many, many more people have moved here. And a lot of people say, well, we need more housing because, you know, the price of housing is going through the roof because there's a lack of supply. We need to increase the housing demand, right? So, you know, the idea would be that, okay, if we just build more places to live, then it'll cost less, or it'll at least control the rapid increase. But what we see is really the opposite, where the kinds of developments that are being put up are places that aren't cheaper. In fact, they're much more expensive than existing housing. And then, you know, once that happens, then everyone else says, oh, well, here's that new average price is much higher, so we have to raise our rents up to match that because that's the market. So really, it's kind of a race to the top as far as, you know, the developers and people trying to make money off of it. It's something that we've kind of seen as a negative, and it's taken on a lot of different forms. But for the most part, gentrification, it's obviously a really bad thing. The root word is gentry, which means upper class. So there's been a lot of talk about sort of the good side of gentrification, and usually that's just trying to pass off revitalization as gentrification, and so that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I moved to Portland in 2002 to go to school at Concordia University, which is in deep northeast Portland, and, you know, I came as a rural Oregonian, and so I didn't have much experience with Portland history, and over the 4 years that I was in school, I had the opportunity to learn quite a bit about the development of that neighborhood, and one of the lessons that I took home, and I suppose I didn't take home all the lessons when I was a college student, it took me well into adulthood to figure it out and sort of like create a narrative for myself, but I did learn a lot about a lot of the displacement that had taken place in that neighborhood, and I saw it changing, and I was able, because, you know, the school I went to was kind of bringing in suburban kids from all over the United States and moving into an urban area, I got to hear the stories of people that live there, but also see like the reaction of people that were kind of moving into that neighborhood at the same time, and had a impression on me that kind of sticks with me to this day. And after I moved back to Portland, I guess like 4 years ago, after I was gone and for a while, I started to see the city changing very quickly. And a lot of the things that I like about the city are going away very quickly. And so I just started asking questions about why this is, what are the forces involved, diving more into the politics of the situation, the economics of the situation. And then most recently, I ran for city council. And one of the issues that we talked about a lot was gentrification and rents going up. And pretty much everywhere I went in the city, this was received, the narrative that I was telling was received very positively. Like, the people were agreeing with what I was saying. And basically what I was saying is that, look, the city is a collectively produced thing. There's a culture that comes from all the people that work here, serve one another, and play, travel here, whatever it might be. We produce a common culture. And pretty much the city of Portland has pioneered this way of creating a brand out of that and using it to draw tourism and using it to draw immigrants into the city from around the country. And then basically whoever can pay the most gets the ability to live in the city, and we consistently push people outward. And this was something that, you know, I didn't know for sure if it would resonate with a lot of the city, but it didn't matter what demographic I was talking to, whether it was like elder folks or whether it was folks in North and North East Portland, or whether it was young people. Like, pretty much everybody's experiencing the same thing at the same time. And so this is a huge issue in the city of Portland right now.
And not just Portland. How does what's happening here fit into larger realities of capitalism across the country and globe?
I don't like the effects, but the descriptive term of capitalism as creative destruction is something that works really, really well with talking about gentrification and now in our era, sort of like re-urbanization. Most people in the world live in cities now, over 50%, and it's projected to grow like crazy. And so we're building our cities very, very fast. But it's not just sort of like this natural thing that happens because everybody wants to live in the urban core. Supply and demand, as Hart was saying earlier, doesn't really just come out of thin air. Like, supply is stimulated and demand is stimulated and all the rest. And so this housing market is at the very center of what capitalism is. If you recall, in the last recession, it was the housing bubble that burst, and then sort of like the global economy started to collapse. We didn't really reform anything after that. And so this is kind of the reimagination of re-engineering our urban space. So it has a lot to do with other issues like climate change as well. But we have precedent even regionally for what this looks like. In San Francisco probably is the greatest example of a city that's been almost totally gentrified in the urban core, totally reestablished, and largely due to the tech industry as well. And so we see sort of similar effects in Portland with tech industry moving in, drawing a lot of tech workers in the city that have a lot of disposable income, and then we build housing for them and so on and so forth. And so the policies of bringing in different industries bring in different kind of residents, which cause different kinds of developments. And all of this is actually coordinated pretty well, right? We don't see the coordination taking place, but because it happens behind closed doors at the Portland Business Alliance and in City Hall and all.
The invisible hand of the market.
Right, right. So, but we talk about, yeah, exactly. It's not an invisible hand. It's totally social engineering that's taking place, but we only see the effects as kind of like these natural, you know, it, like, it's gravity hitting us. Like, what are we supposed to do about it?
Because we're not participating in our lives.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so the question about the right to the city, you know, is it's a question about democracy as well. Like, okay, well, if these aren't natural forces that are taking place, why is it that developers and business interests and industry and City Hall get to make all these decisions instead of our communities? And so one of the things that was really resonating with people in the city is when we talk about, look, there's nothing that says that our city charter couldn't allow for residents to have input very early on in developments, and not the traditional way that Portland does democracy, where we like have a project that's 90% completed already and then you get to put the bow on the top of it or something like that, right? Actually having a legal say in what kind of developments that you would have.
On Hart's website, rebelmetropolis.org, you cover a lot about gentrification and how people are talking about it and what that means for how we respond to it. And one point that you stress is that gentrification and capitalist development are not about producing for human need, but for making profit. And could you say why this is so important to keep at the front of our conversation about gentrification?
A lot of my background is in sort of what we call like the livable streets movement, or, you know, sort of bicycle pedestrian advocacy. And you know, a lot of the folks that are trying to have, you know, safer streets or better streets for walking and biking are very well-meaning. However, the way that this is applied, the way the city, when it implements a lot of these bike ped projects, is, you know, sort of a watch out for it, because then afterwards here come a bunch of condos. We saw that with, like, North Williams. They were going to try to improve the bike access up there, and everybody in the community was like, well, you know, we don't have a problem with the bike lanes, but we know what's going to come afterwards, and it's going to push us out of the community. So seeing that and realizing that these improvements usually only get pushed through if it's designed to push people out and bring in people that are wealthier really got me to pay attention to that sort of cycle of deinvesting and then reinvesting, but in order to push people around. So I really, you know, I want people to be able to walk around and bike, but I want people to be able to afford to live in those communities where they can do that. You know, you shouldn't have to only be able to afford to live out by the freeway breathing polluted air. You know, everyone should be able to afford to live in a city. Everyone should have a right to the city. So a couple of years ago, me and Nick started kind of working together on a lot of these things, and a lot of the stuff that, you know, where I was coming from was stuff where that Nick was coming from as well. So we have worked together on a lot of these projects. But yeah, Rebel Metropolis is a website. I've written a lot about this. There's another blog that Nick and I both write on called mismanagingperception.com. We've written about a few things about Right to the City there as well.
Well, before we wrap up, we should talk about the ride itself. It starts in Colonel Sumner's Park, which is on the corner of Belmont and 20th, and it'll start at 5:30. Basically, it's going to be a tour of different sites of gentrification, where houses have been torn down, where new apartment buildings are being built, and where people are being displaced, either from their homes or from other ways that they utilize the city. Hart and Nick will be there, but more importantly, there will be people from around Portland gathering to talk about how they have been affected and what kind of collective, community-oriented solutions we might seek. Where are you hoping to go, Hart?
Well, hopefully we can cover a lot of ground. However, we've already got about 86 people that have RSVP'd. So with a group that big, you know, it tends to limit the range of space you can cover. We want to go to a few different sites that people are probably have heard about that are about to be, you know, have massive new developments coming in. There might be a few that people didn't know about, you know, and they might be surprised to learn that something new is coming in that they didn't realize. I feel like a lot of people got really focused, at least here in Inner Buckman, about the carts at 12th and Hawthorne that are about to be pushed out and replaced with a pretty large apartment building. However, that's still, like, you know, it's like we're not really so concerned about the food carts themselves as we are about, you know, the people's actual lives being displaced. So yeah, it should be a lot of fun. We're going to have some good discussion about what we can do as a community to organize to stop a lot of these things, or at least have a greater deal of say in the process of what we want our communities to look like.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this on-air portion of our conversation. I've been talking with Hart Noeker and Nick Caleb about gentrification and the right to the city. We're actually going to continue it for another good 20 or 30 minutes, and you'll be able to hear the rest of it online when we post the Old Mole to the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll talk more about these issues of gentrification and green capitalism and capitalism in general. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The way they've arranged things, you think you can't change things. You're one, you're just you. But whatever they do, don't forget to remember you're a name, not a number, and no one can think for you, dream for you, speak for you. Don't let them bind you down, don't let them grind you down, don't let them mold you till one day, behold, your obedient tools, your commuters, consumers, and reality rules out your dreams. Only listen for the voice that lives inside you. Like a songbird in a cage, it waits in silence. Find the key to set it free and soar in sky.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before that, we heard me talking with Hart Nowicker and Nick Caleb. We had a really good conversation that went on beyond that, and you can go and find it online in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, to wrap up today's show, Lori Mercier is here today to talk with Eric DePlace of the Sightline Institute about oil terminals that are slated or desired to be put on the Columbia River and the environmental impact that they have. They'll also be mentioning a Vancouver City Council meeting that you may be able to attend tonight to voice your concerns. Lori?
Thanks, Joe. Eric DePlace is Policy Director and Policy Analyst for Sightline, an independent research center based in Seattle that focuses on sustainability issues facing the Pacific Northwest. He spearheads Sightline's work on climate and energy policy, writes extensively about coal and oil exports, and he's considered an authority on a range of issues connected to fossil fuel transport, which is why we have him with us today, since this evening the Vancouver City Council considers public testimony about a resolution it has drafted in opposition to a proposed large oil facility to be located at the Port of Vancouver. Welcome to KBOO, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. And many residents of Vancouver have mobilized in opposition to the proposed oil terminal, have brought some regional attention to a major development happening throughout the Northwest, the extensive plans to receive almost 500,000 barrels of oil a day as increased production of the tar sands of Alberta and shale deposits of North Dakota seek access to ports in the Northwest. First, tell us how the oil trains, which have been increasing with very little attention, and even this proposed terminal in Vancouver, I think, has had little attention on the other side of the Columbia in Portland, and how the proposed fuel depot in Vancouver and other Northwest spots where terminals are proposed, how do these threaten the climate?
Yeah, well, this is, it's really something new under the sun, and I think it's fair to say that it caught a lot of people by surprise, even those of us who study the oil industry and study the fossil fuel shipment industries. This sudden influx of oil trains and the sudden influx of proposals to move even more oil by rail, it really started nationally and in the Northwest about 2012. It started ramping up, and since that time, we have seen just this gush of proposals to build oil infrastructure everywhere from the Columbia River up to Puget Sound. And it actually, you know, if you add up all of the new projects that have been either built or proposed since 2012, it's about 850,000, 860,000 barrels per day. So actually more oil proposed just for Oregon and Washington than the entire Keystone XL pipeline would carry. It could be Canadian tar sands that's coming. It could be shale oil from the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. But really a tidal wave of oil moving from these big fossil deposits in the interior of the continent to port terminals and refineries on the coast. I think much of it probably destined for export. So the climate significance of that is, you know, really comparable to Keystone XL. And that's just oil trains, again, in the Pacific Northwest that are new in the last couple of years. So it's a big, big deal.
Yeah, and certainly there's been a lot of attention on Keystone, but I'm not sure most people in the Northwest realize this kind of flow of oil is really threatening our region in major ways. And in addition to the effects on the climate, how do these oil trains and their massive expansion affect other kinds of considerations in terms of the local environment, the local economy, culture, et cetera?
Right. Well, it's been very interesting to watch these developments because, you know, I'm not in any way trying to minimize the importance of Keystone. Keystone is rightly held up as a sort of the flagship test of Obama's commitment to the environment, and that's right. But it's worth using as a sort of a measure of comparison that we're looking at something just as big here, just in terms of oil trains, to say nothing of the pipelines in BC or the coal terminals and all the rest of it. The biggest of the oil train proposals is right across the Columbia River from Portland, right there in Vancouver, Washington. And it's been really interesting to watch that community respond because the business community there is by and large not wild about the idea of putting 360,000 barrels of oil per day through the Port of Vancouver. The local longshoremen are coming out against it. The city council, as you mentioned earlier, is poised to take an opposition vote on it tonight. So you have the port sort of conditionally approving it, and the city council saying, wait a second, this is not a good deal for the community. And in my judgment, the opponents are absolutely right. Oil trains are risky for a whole bunch of reasons, everything from the global climate all the way down to the fact that they have this nasty tendency, as folks have seen over the last year, to explode catastrophically. In one case, they killed 47 people in a small town in Quebec. And those explosions, those derailments have continued. So it's not something you want in your neighborhood by any stretch of the imagination. And it's not something you want in your community if you're concerned about any form of long-term sustainable job growth or economic development.
Now, you have said that Vancouver is the epicenter of the oil trains in the Northwest. What do you mean by that? Is this just a much larger project than the other terminals proposed or in existence in the region?
It's much, much larger. It would be the biggest oil facility by far in the Pacific Northwest, bigger than any of the refineries on Puget Sound, bigger than any pipeline that currently flows into the region. It's just absolutely enormous. And it's all pointed to Vancouver, Washington. So we'd have about five or so loaded oil trains per day and then five empty ones rolling out just to serve that depot. Then taking all that oil off the trains, putting it in storage tanks, then moving it from the storage tanks to barges or ocean-going vessels, and then taking those out to Columbia to points unknown. So we're talking about moving an awful lot of oil in a very sensitive area in a place that does have some navigational hazards. And that really puts at risk a lot of what we think about being sort of the best parts of the greater Portland area right there. So it's in terms of kind of the sea change that this represents in the Northwest energy infrastructure, it's pretty gigantic. I don't know that I've ever seen anything like this in my lifetime proposed.
And people in Vancouver have been reacting to this in a big way. Even though the Port of Vancouver approved this location or siting without public input, once people heard, people at the grassroots have been jamming every kind of hearing that's been held over the last year, including last week when the state's Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council met. And people jammed that meeting. And in fact, the Vancouver City Council has had to relocate to a larger venue tonight at 6:30. They've located to the Hilton in order to accommodate the over 1,000 people who are anticipated to attend. But how can people actually, clearly in opposition to the location of the terminal, really affect state policy? Because apparently this State Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council makes a recommendation to the governor who can ultimately rule on this.
That's right. It's in a sort of special regulatory space where it will, as you say, the FSEC, which is the sort of colloquial name for that body, will make a recommendation to the governor, and the governor will give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And he's basically Governor Inslee's sole discretion, and he'll take the recommendations of FSEC seriously, of course. But it's going to land on his desk. In my judgment, we need to do a whole bunch of things. We need to make it clear that the public loudly, clearly, and repeatedly opposes these things. They are not a good idea for our economy. They are a terrible idea for our environment. And, we're playing whack-a-mole to a certain extent. So we need to make sure that we stop it in Vancouver, Washington. We need to stop it in Portland. We need to stop it in Grays Harbor, Washington. And we need to stop it on Puget Sound. But we need strong, just unflinching citizen opposition to these proposals. And we're seeing that in Vancouver, by the way. We're seeing it, a very diverse, sort of broad swath of folks, including the business community, speak out against these things. And then we need to make sure that the governor of Washington understands that this is not something that is in the best interests of his state or of the state next door that shares the Columbia River with us. So there is a huge value in showing up to these meetings and making the opposition heard loudly and clearly, and in gathering resolutions of opposition from local communities, from city councils, and so on. We've seen that in other places as well. Spokane City Council, for example, came out with a very strong unanimous statement of opposition. Seattle recently did the same thing. I'm excited to see one in the works in Vancouver as well.
And this kind of mobilization is exciting in other ways, in that the Northwest plays such a strategic role in turning around this kind of fossil fuels production. I mean, how can the region itself really change the steady march to fossil fuel production and acceleration and climate change? How can we in this region really begin to block that?
Yeah, you ask a great question. I like to refer to the Pacific Northwest right now at this moment in history. We are, in a real sense, the thin green line that stands between these huge deposits of fossil fuels in the interior of the continent and the world's hungriest energy markets in Asia. And if you think of the swath of land between basically Coos Bay and Prince Rupert in British Columbia, it's that swath of land where we've seen 5 natural gas pipelines proposed, 2 new oil pipelines, you know, a dozen oil by rail proposals, 6 coal terminal expansions. All that stuff wants to move on. Some of the industry wants to move it from these big remote fossil fuel deposits in the interior to Asia, and that means they need our permission slips to do that. So it's a very curious turn of history where this region that has prided itself on environmental leadership, prided itself on a green progressive economy, is now suddenly looking at this tsunami of fossil fuels heading our way and having to decide whether we continue with our legacy of environmental leadership and say, no, we're not going to move this stuff, or whether we become a carbon export hub of global consequence.
And of course, Tesoro and Savage Oil Companies, who are proposing the terminal, claim that this will create jobs for the economy. That's always what's held up as the carrot for communities to buy into the terminals. But there are really very few jobs that are associated with the development of these terminals, right?
Very few jobs, and you know, like I mentioned earlier, the local longshoremen not wild about this proposal because the threat of an oil spill on the Columbia would risk many, many more jobs. You know, Tesoro has a very fractious relationship with workers. I think if there were a dictionary, entry for bad corporate actor, Tesoro would probably be listed there. They have, you know, a string of problems with worker safety and with environmental hazards. Some of which I've enumerated already, and I'd be happy to share with your audience in detail later on. I would take with a whole shaker full of salt any claims that they have that they make about their economic benefits to the region, because I think I'm very dubious about that.
Well, Eric DePlace, thank you so much for joining us today. And we want to remind listeners to refer to the Sightline website for great information about the proposed oil terminals and trains traveling through the Northwest. That's Sightline, Sightline.org. And also to remind listeners that the Vancouver City Council public hearing will be held tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the Hilton. And if you can't attend, it will be broadcast by Cable Access TV in Vancouver, CVTV. I think that's Comcast Channel 23, certainly online for CVTV. And thanks very much, Eric DePlace, for all your good work. And listeners, do take a look at the Sightline website.
Thank you so much, Laurie. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and Eric DePlace talking about how you can stop oil depots from going up in the Columbia River. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Phyllis Bennis for talking about U.S. foreign policy. For Ivan Hale for her commentary about community mental health and dealing with volatile people. And for Hart Noeker and Nick Caleb for coming on to talk about their Petalpalooza ride touring sites of gentrification in Portland. You can find the Old Mole at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where we post the show in its entirety and as segments that you can share individually. And we also add more links so that you enrich your listening experience. Up next, we're going to hear Air Cascadia with Cutting Edge News, Views, and Just Plain Horse Sense with Chris Andre. And after that, Locus Focus will be on with host Barbara Bernstein. Oh, no, with guest host Chris Siegel, talking with Dan Barber, author of the book The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food.
and Good Morning coming up this morning on KBOO. Right up at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Chris Siegel guest host Locus Focus. He'll speak with award-winning chef Dan Barber, author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. And at 11 on Health Watch, the guest is Dr. Jeffrey Bland, a leader in the functional medicine movement, which seeks to pinpoint and prevent the cause of illness rather than treat its symptoms. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Erica Vanderacker discusses her innovative counseling work with violent offenders in the Netherlands. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And you are tuned, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series. June 7th at 7 p.m. will show Meet the Falkins. Louise and Martine Falkins are identical twins. For over 50 years, they were working as prostitutes. They freed themselves from the control of their pimps, ran their own brothel, and set up the first informal trade union for prostitutes. Meet the Falkins is a portrait of these women. Again, that's June 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.